Welcome to this web-only extra of Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Remember the Australian wildfires? The ones that killed some 1 billion animals and torched millions of acres of land? Well, Australia is still in fire season. And as late as yesterday, February 5th, fires were still raging. There's a temporary reprieve as Australia braces for torrential rainfall. But they will no doubt be back. A few days ago, I spoke by Skype with journalist Daniel Jutt about his recent piece in The Nation, Australia's Devastating Wildfires Were Not Inevitable. Here's that interview now. Well, Daniel Jutt, welcome to the show here. Your article, Australia's Devastating Wildfires Were Not Inevitable, is the second in a three-part series. First of all, you begin this article by going to what is, or at least was, a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Tell us where you were. Put us there.
Well, thanks so much for having me on the show. The UNESCO World Heritage Site where I visited to report from just before Christmas was just about 100 kilometers outside of Sydney. It's called the Blue Mountains. It's a township that is actually a kind of set of towns nestled in these beautiful rolling hills just west of the city. And it's frequently in the summer beset by threats from wildfires. So citizens of the Blue Mountains are no strangers to the idea of fires threatening their doorstep. As recently as 2016, dozens of homes were destroyed in one of the towns in the Blue Mountains as fires swept through. But when I went, what I saw and heard from residents and from city officials and from firefighters was that this summer was not normal. There was nothing even remotely close to precedent for the kinds of fires that they were experiencing in the Blue Mountains just before Christmas. Fires that, I should say, as we speak now in February, are still ongoing in New South Wales, which is the state in which Sydney and the Blue Mountains are located in Australia.
People say, you know, Australia's always had brush fires. Some of the fires were set. I mean, in fact, I went to a local event here and I was talking about the Australian fires to the person sitting next to me. And she said, oh, you know, all those fires were set and had nothing to do with climate change. So talk about how this is different and what makes it different.
So I suppose two things to say on that. The first, which is really important, is that not all of these fires were set. And it's worth just kind of getting out in front of that myth and dispelling it. This is one of the idea that there are arsonists running around lighting all of these bushfires, and that's what's made this season so much worse, is an idea that has been test run by the Liberal National Coalition, which is currently in power in Australia. Liberal in Australia means conservative in the US. They use it in the kind of libertarian European sense. So the idea has been perpetrated by some representatives in government and then also by a lot of newspapers in Australia owned by the Murdochs, and Rupert Murdoch's influence in the climate conversation in Australia is much greater and more pervasive than even it is in the United States through Fox News. So that's important to understand. What is driving these fires, unequivocally, and this is something that all of the scientists I spoke to confirmed, and all of the firefighters on the ground who have been fighting these fires for decades in some cases, also confirmed, that what is driving these fires is climate change. And it's driving them in three specific ways. First, it's making the conditions for bushfires in Australia begin much earlier. So we started talking about these fires as an international community in late December, early January. If you lived in Australia, in New South Wales, these fires have been going on since September. That's very early in the season. And that makes it a lot harder for firefighters to burn preemptively, which they often do to try and prepare for a bad fire season. So that's something that climate change has altered. The second thing it's changed is it's made the conditions for the fires much worse. So Australia was the hottest it's ever been in 2019. That broke the previous record, which was 2018. And you can see where that trend is going. And it's also in the second of two millennium droughts, 200-year droughts, as they call them, which are meant to be droughts that come only 100 years, once in 100 years. Two of them have come in the last 10 years. So exceptionally hot and exceptionally dry. And the third thing that climate change has done for these fires is it's meant that places that didn't burn before in Australia are now dry and hot and parched enough that they are burning in ways that no firefighter I talked to had ever seen. So to give you an example, some of the land around the Blue Mountains is actually rainforest, and that land is burning now. And I had the former fire chief of New South Wales, a guy named Greg Mullins, who's been very outspoken on the connection between the fires and climate change, tell me that he never thought that land would burn, could burn, and here it is. So there's no doubt that the reason these fires are the way they are is the changing climate.
So this article's subtitle, the title being Australia's Devastating Wildfires Were Not Inevitable, Daniel Jutt, the subtitle is the country was once actually poised to lead on climate politics. So tell us what was then and what's the politics about it now?
One of the things that I discovered while I was reporting this story is how many politicians and also local citizens regretted at this point the fact that Australia really was, just over a decade ago, poised to be one of the international leaders on climate action. So to understand what happened, you have to go back to 2007. And in 2007, according to a poll run by Australia's leading think tank, the Lowy Institute, 68% of Australians believed that climate change was an urgent problem that needed an immediate solution, and they would be willing to support that solution even if there were costs involved. As a result, because of that public opinion, politicians on both sides of the aisle supported an emissions trading scheme in the election in 2007. Now, what ended up happening in that election is that the Labour Party, the party on the left in Australia, won, tried to negotiate an emissions trading scheme with the Liberal Party. The negotiations fell apart. And from that point on, you had a split that looks much more, in terms familiar to Americans, like Democrats and Republicans over climate change. The Liberal Party, instead of supporting an emissions trading scheme, became the party of climate denial. They were backed by significant money from the fossil fuel industry, especially coal. And the Labour Party became a bit scared of its shadow and didn't want to push for hard climate action on the fear that the public would react by voting them out of office. So very reminiscent of the Democrats in the US after they failed to pass an emissions trading scheme around the same time. And since then, to take you to now, what we've had is an increasing divide between, on the one hand, a Labour Party that believes in the science behind climate change and believes in the importance of climate action, but is wary of using that as a piece of its electoral politics, lest it be kicked out of its main voting region, which is in Queensland, another state in Australia, which is roughly equivalent to our coal country in Appalachia. And on the other hand, a Liberal Party that is determined to use climate denial of a certain pervasive kind, which we can talk about, in order to boost its immediate electoral chances against Labour. And the issue has become one of the most divisive rifts in Australian politics over the last decade.
It does seem kind of unbelievable that this has happened, and also all this around coal, which is being phased out, you know, certainly in the United States. Renewables are less expensive than coal, even at this point. So how is the coal lobby able to maintain its draconian grip on these politics?
It's a really great question, and I wish I had a better answer than the one that I do. So when I spoke to Julianne Richards, who's the head of the executive director of the Climate Action Network in Australia, which is a climate activist group. And I asked her what the main problem with climate politics in Australia was. She immediately said two words: coal lobby. And I think to understand the power of the coal lobby in Australia, a good analogy, and one that's been increasingly made in the American press, would be to think about the NRA in the US. So the power is fundraising. There are huge coal magnates like Clive Palmer and Gina Rinehart, who are household names in Australia, who give money to the Liberal Party to keep coal subsidies going, which goes to your question about how coal can subsist when it's cheaper than renewables. And then on the other hand, there's a kind of cultural pressure. Coal and more generally natural resources like natural gas as well, which is another big component of the Australian fossil fuel industry, have been essential to the character of Australia's economy, at least as it's mythologized in the way that politicians speak about it, for a very long time. So to sum it up in an example, Scott Morrison, who's the current Prime Minister of Australia, is known and became known in 2017 when, as Treasurer at that point, he took the floor of Parliament with a lump of coal in his hand and said, "This is coal, don't be afraid," mocking the opposing party. And that's the kind of cultural force that coal still has in Australian politics.
Coal is more expensive than renewables.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did I say the other way around? Yes, absolutely.
One of the most interesting things that you say, and that really gave me pause, was that while one would think that this apocalyptic climate season would lead to a backlash to the fossil fuel lobby, you say it's not as simple as that. So tell us what's going on and how you lay out a fork in the road that we're at right now, that Australia's at.
So one thing that I came into reporting this story thinking about was how, in many ways, 2019 was the year the world woke up to the climate crisis, or at least the privileged Western world. There have been a lot of countries that have been very aware of the climate crisis for a long time. But with school strikes, with Greta Thunberg, with the Sunrise Movement and the Green New Deal in the US, there's been a renewed focus on climate change in a way that there just hasn't been before in my lifetime. And I was hoping, to kind of reveal my biases too, that these fires would have some silver lining, in that they would be a tipping point in the right direction and would move people to act and push their government to act on climate action. What I ended up seeing in Australia was something a bit more complicated, in that it was often hard to tell, and the people I spoke to were themselves quite unsure of whether this would be a tipping point towards climate action or a tipping point towards climate reaction. And what I mean by that is that the response from the government so far, led by Prime Minister Scott Morrison, has been not to deny the science of climate change. They've accepted that is real. And it's been not to say that these fires weren't caused by climate change. They agree that the fires were significantly supercharged or exacerbated by climate change. But what they're saying instead is, we've already acted in Australia. We've done our part, as Morrison likes to put it. They advertise meeting their targets of the Paris Agreement at a canter or easily. None of this, as I explained in the article, is really true. And it's based on some very disingenuous accounting done in international treaties by Australia that is meant to give the impression that they've already acted on climate change, when in fact they haven't. And what gave me pause, and I think what you're referencing in your question, is the idea that far from being the moment when we tip towards better climate action, one more sinister outcome of these fires could be that as the conditions in Australia become more and more normally apocalyptic, we move towards a kind of climate action that consists not of changing the way we use fossil fuels in the future, but of denying the way that we've used fossil fuels in the past. So instead of acting forward, we retroactively rewrite the record. Cooking the books would be the more colloquial way to put it. And I fear that that's what's happening in Australia right now.
Are there any forces that you feel can move against that in Australia?
So in my time reporting there, I did see quite a few protests run by climate activist groups like Extinction Rebellion and the Climate Action Network, but also protests that were more organic than that and that came from citizens in Sydney, in Melbourne, breathing smoke all day and becoming absolutely fed up with the conditions that they were finding their cities in, and quite frankly, alarmed. I wonder and hope, I hope that those kinds of protests will persist and will lead to the kind of electoral activity and push that would put a party in power in Australia that will give the country a better climate politics than it has right now. But I do have to say, Francesca, that it seemed to me 2.5 years out of an election. Morrison was elected just last April, and Australia has elections in 3 or 4 year cycles. It seemed hard to believe that this memory of the fires was going to last that long. And this was really driven home for me by Mayor Mark Greenhill of the Blue Mountains, who, when he was driving me past these scenes of fires and smoke in the valleys around his town, said, when I asked him if this would provoke a better turn for climate action, just laughed and said, yeah, until winter comes and then the bastards forget about it. And I think the hope that we have to have is that through activism and through continuous journalism, we make sure that the folks don't forget about it when winter comes.
Well, hear, hear, and your journalism is an important element of that. Daniel Judd, thank you so much for talking with us here about your piece for the Nation. Australia's devastating wildfires were not inevitable. It's the second in a 3-part series, and we will link to both that as well as your earlier piece in the series.
Thanks so much for having me on.
This has been a web-only extra of Writer's Voice with Francesca Rhiannon, part of our climate series.